My Life with Martin Luther King, Jr. The summer of 1964 had been very difficult for my husband, Martin Luther King, Jr. The calls upon him were staggering, and his life was filled with almost incredible pressures. He was away from our home in Atlanta much of the time, involved in the struggle for voter registration, in the movement to integrate public facilities, in a trip to Germany, in the presidential campaign, and in many other difficult and strenuous tasks. Because I was concerned about him in October soon after he returned from Germany, I encouraged my husband to go to St. Joseph's Hospital in Atlanta for a checkup, hoping that he would, in that way, be able to get a few days' rest. At about 9 o'clock on the morning after Martin went to the hospital, the telephone rang. It rang most of the time in our house. Many of the calls were from people with whom Martin worked, or who wanted to give support to the movement, or who wanted help from him. But many times the telephone brought threats, abuse, and a stream of obscenity. This time when I answered, the voice on the line said, "This is the Associated Press. I would like to speak with Dr. Martin Luther King." I explained that Dr. King was not at home, and the reporter said, "Is this Mrs. King?" When I replied that it was, he said, "We've just received word from Norway that your husband has been given the Nobel Peace Prize for 1964. Of course, I had read in newspaper stories that Martin was being considered for the prize. After that, we heard that he was high on the list of possible winners. But Martin and I both thought these reports were merely rumors, for we thought that the prize was given only to those occupied exclusively in international peace activities. Though Martin had often written and spoken of nonviolence as the salvation of a world in peril, we did not feel others saw the broad implications of his philosophy. This year, the prize is worth $54,000, the reporter said. What do you suppose Dr. King will do with all that money?" "Knowing him," I answered, "I'm sure he will give it all to the freedom movement." "How do you feel about that?" "I think this is where the money should go. I believe in it wholeheartedly." As the reporter hung up, I called Martin at the hospital. When he answered in a sleepy voice, I said, gaily, "How is the Nobel Peace Prize winner for 1964 feeling this morning?" "What's that?" Martin asked. "Martin, the Associated Press just called to tell us that the announcement has been made and you are the winner." After a long silence, Martin said, "I'd better check to see if this is true." Martin told me later that he had fallen asleep after his early morning breakfast at the hospital. When I called him with the news, he was stunned. He thought he was still dreaming. It took me quite a while to analyze my own reactions. Of course, the phone kept ringing, and my first thought was that Martin had checked into the hospital only the day before, and this meant that he would get absolutely no rest because there would be all kinds of people trying to get to him. It seems as if every time he got to the point where he wanted to get away from things, something would happen. On the other hand, I realized that this was exactly the sort of lift Martin desperately needed. And in that moment, I was filled with joy. I sat quietly by the telephone and I prayed, "Thank you, our Father. Thank you for what this means to Martin and to the children and to me. Thank you, and help us to be worthy of this blessing." News of the announcement of the prize spread rapidly. Martin was visited by Archbishop Hallinan of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Atlanta. Bishop Hallinan offered his congratulations and then said to Martin, "May I give you my blessing?" Martin said, "Of course." And the Archbishop recited a traditional blessing and made a sign of the cross. Martin responded, then to his surprise, The Archbishop sank to his knees beside the bed and quietly said, "May I receive your blessing?" Later, Martin told me how humbled he felt and how beautiful it was that a Roman Catholic Archbishop would receive the blessing of a Baptist preacher named Martin Luther. Of course, I was pleased, but at the same time, I was pondering why. Why was Martin's contribution considered of international importance? What was the deeper meaning of all this, some meaning that we were not yet able to understand? For this was not just a prize for civil rights, but for contributing to world peace. Though we were very happy, both Martin and I realized the tremendous responsibility that this placed on him. This was, of course, the greatest recognition that had come to him, but we both knew that to accomplish what the prize really implied, we still had a long way to go. It was a great tribute, but an even more awesome burden. I felt pride and joy, and pain, too, when I thought of the added responsibilities my husband must bear. And it was my burden, too. I think he put it best for both of us when he later said in his acceptance speech, "I feel as though this prize has been given to me for something that really has not yet been achieved. It is a commission to go out and work even harder for the things in which we believe." Later still, when we were in Oslo, Daddy King began to talk about his emotions. "I want to say something to all of you now," he began, "and I want you to listen." He raised his finger to focus our attention in the way he does when he speaks from the pulpit in Ebenezer Church. "I want to try to tell you how I feel. I guess most of you know this, but I just have to say it now anyway." He stopped to draw a deep breath and let it out slowly, as he does when he is gathering his thoughts. "I came from nowhere. My father was a sharecropper, and I didn't have the opportunity to get much formal training when I was growing up. It wasn't until I left the farm and went to Atlanta that I was able to get any real education. I was a man when I finished college. A grown man with my wife and three children. I wanted my children to have all the things I had not had. I prayed for the Lord to let them do the things I could not do. This young man here became a minister, and I wanted him to have the best training available so he was able to get his PhD. Then Daddy King talked about the struggle over the years and how difficult it had been for him and Mama King to live with the knowledge that what Martin was doing was so dangerous. He talked of the threats they had been subjected to, the two of them. He said, "You don't know how it feels when some stranger calls you on the phone and tells you that he wants to kill you or kill your son." By now, we were all crying. And Daddy King, standing there so big and kind, not bitter at all, said, "I have to talk about this, because even though I feel so proud tonight about what is happening here in Oslo, I must also be humble. I don't want to get puffed up with pride. I'm not that kind of person. So I have to continue to pray so that the Lord will keep me humble. The devil is busy out there, and we have to pray that God will keep my son safe." We were crying because we had all come such a long way. The ceremony was held in Aula of Oslo University. When the speech was over, Dr. Jean presented Martin with a prize, a gold medal and the scroll. Then Martin stepped up to the rostrum to make his acceptance speech. After paying the preliminary courtesies, Martin said, I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children, crying out for brotherhood, were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death. I'm mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not won the very peace and brotherhood which is the essence of the Nobel Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I receive on behalf of the movement, is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and racial questions of our time, the need for man to overcome oppression without resorting to violence. I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in mankind. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life which surrounds him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daylight of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. As I sat listening to Martin, I tried to remind myself of Daddy King's words about humility. Yet I could not help myself. I was proud of Martin and of what he stood for. I was proud that his work and that of his associates had made better the lives of so many of our countrymen. I was proud that black people all over the world had felt renewed courage and hope because of this man, my husband. Forgive me, Lord, I prayed silently. Forgive me if I'm filled with pride, but that's how I feel. I'm so proud of Martin and what he has tried to do that I am worse than puffed up. I feel as if I might burst. Lord, have mercy. While we were in Oslo, we spoke of the long road we had come, but no one who had not traveled it could possibly envision how very long it was. Martin and I both had a heritage deeply rooted in southern soil. I had grown up in the rural South while he was a product of the urban South. Consequently, our backgrounds were dissimilar. I was born in a modest house on my grandfather's farm, 12 miles out in the county from Marion, Alabama. My father, Obadiah Scott, whom everybody calls Obi, built the house in 1920, the year he and my mother, Bernice McMurray Scott, married. My father is an unusual person, as you had to be to get anywhere at all in those days if you were black. A born leader, he was a good combination of both his parents. I often wonder how he and Daddy King ever made it, for all the cards were stacked against them. They were both born at the beginning of the century, which, in the South, was the very worst period of the repression of the Negro since the days of slavery. After the Civil War, when the Negroes were made free by the Emancipation Proclamation and given the vote and legal equality by the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, things were better for a while. Black people did vote, and they enjoyed a certain amount of freedom. Then the federal occupation troops were pulled out, and the white Southerners began the process of eroding Negro rights. They were a little careful at first, but in the 1880s and 1890s, with very conservative Republican federal governments in office, the local governments really clamped down. It was then that several of the southern states put the grandfather clauses in their constitutions. Under these rulings, no one was eligible to vote unless his grandfather had been a voter. Of course, most of our grandfathers had been slaves, so that effectively disfranchised almost the entire population. Another device to keep blacks from voting was the high poll tax. It cost $2 to vote in Alabama, but if you were, for example, 30 years old the first time you voted, you had to pay all the back taxes from the time you were 21. In this case, $20. A large part of the annual income of many people at that time. This trick was almost as effective as the grandfather clauses, because very few black people could afford to pay that much to vote. In 1940, in Marion and the surrounding countryside where we lived, there were about 1,000 whites and 2,000 Negroes. But even as late as 1955, only about 150 black people were registered to vote. That was not the worst of it. After the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of the Supreme Court in 1896 legalizing segregation, or separate but equal facilities, the Jim Crow laws passed by the white legislatures went to horrible and ridiculous lengths. They made it illegal for blacks and whites to eat together in public, to sit together in theaters, buses, or trains, to use the same comfort stations or water fountains, even to enter public buildings by the same door. It was as though the blacks had some contagious disease. And yet, we worked in their houses, prepared their food, nursed their children, and were intimately associated with them in every domestic way. The whole idea was to impress upon the black people that we were an inferior race, to reduce us not to slavery again, but to being less than men. Negroes, no matter what their positions or how much education they had, were never called Mr. or any other title. They were addressed as boy, a girl, even if they were old and gray. They were supposed to say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, even to teenage whites. It was all deliberately aimed at instilling the slave mentality in our people. Unhappily, the whites succeeded all too frequently for many years. How sad it made me feel to see some of our people who had been so badly treated. When they spoke to a white person, their backbone seemed to crumple. They seemed diminished. After we became involved in the movement, Martin would say to his oppressed brothers and sisters, "We can straighten up our backs and walk erect now. We are walking to freedom and dignity." During those early years, any Negro who stood up like a man was considered uppity if he went too far, or even if he merely tried to assert his legal rights, he was in grave danger of disappearing. The authorities never investigated. A black man's life was worthless. Of course, in any direct clash or an accusation by a white woman against him, the Negro man was almost invariably lynched. One of my great uncles was lynched. A kindly white woman came and told his wife what had happened. When she went out looking, she found his body hanging from a tree. After they had strung him up, the lynch mob must have used him for a target practice. His body was full of bullet holes. The system of slavery and consequent segregation as practiced in the United States is the most vicious and evil sin against humanity anywhere. It created within the white man a false sense of superiority, while instilling in the black man a false sense of inferiority. Racism, as we define it today, is deeply rooted in these inhuman practices. It is a wonder that my own father did not end up in a swamp because of his obvious self-respect. His additional and unforgivable crime was that he worked too hard and he got ahead. Ahead of some of the poor whites. He was the only Negro who owned a truck. This brought him into competition with the whites, and they resented him. Sometimes they would stop him on a lonely road and curse him and threaten to kill him. and there was always a good chance they might do it. He was not a big man, only 5'7", but he had a lot of courage. He never ran away, and I'm sure that is why he survived. He would stand up to them quietly and respectfully. My father used to say, "If you look a white man in the eye, he can't hurt you." Daddy knew it was dangerous. After receiving so many open threats, he bought a pistol and carried it in the glove compartment of his truck. But I don't think he would have shot anyone. It would have been against all his principles. Many times during these years, when he left home to go into the deep woods to haul lumber, he'd say to Mother, "I may not get back." I learned very early to live with fear for the people I loved. It was good training, for I have lived that way most of my life. My father, in his bravery and his refusal to be beaten down, is very much the same kind of man my husband was. Even before my sister and I started school, my parents began to instill in us a desire for education. We had a few books in our home, which we read and reread. Among the ones which I remember, Mother used to read stories to us about Rumpelstiltskin and the Little Match Girl. We learned Mary Had a Little Lamb, Humpty Dumpty, and other nursery rhymes. Mother had only a fourth grade education, which she got going to school 3 months a year, minding cows and working in the fields the rest of the time. She married when she was 16 and began to have children. She used to say, "I never was a child. I've been a woman all my life." When I first remember her, she must have been still in her early 20s. When she did her hair in braids, she looked like an Indian. Unlike my father, who is open-hearted and open-handed, my mother is reserved and cautious with strangers, especially white people. "You can't trust any of them," she said, though she does have white friends now whom she likes. But once she accepted you as a friend, she opened her heart. Despite her lack of education, she had a good mind and had a lot of practical wisdom and understanding of life. She seemed more resentful of the injustice done Negroes than my father, who says that people are bad because conditions make them that way. He chooses to think the best about people. My parents realized how much they had missed by not going through school, and my mother was determined that her children would get an education. Despite efforts by Negro parents to protect their children from the dreadful hurt of segregation and discrimination, sooner or later, all Negro children lose their racial innocence. Some incident suddenly makes them realize that they are regarded as inferior. White children may suddenly refuse to play with them, or they find out that they have to sit on the hard wooden seats in the hot, crowded balcony at the movies, as we did, instead of in the comfortable orchestra. Then I always smile a little when I hear white people talking nostalgically about the corner drugstore. I remember when I was a very little girl, having to go to the side door of the white-owned drugstore with the other Negro children to buy an ice cream cone. I would have to wait until all the white children were served, and then, no matter what flavor I asked for, the man would give me whatever he had too much of. Of course, we paid exactly what the white kids paid. Black children realize very early that there are places that they cannot go. When that time comes, they go to their mothers and ask, "Why?" Every Negro mother says, "You are just as good as anyone else. It's just the way things are." With his deep hurt, the child realizes that his mother's trying to explain without explaining, and that she wouldn't have to tell him that if there weren't some problem. And it is hard for a child to believe when everything is rigged to prove it is not so. When I went to my own mother with this eternal question of black children, she too said, You are just as good as anyone else. And then she said very forcefully, you get an education and try to be somebody. Then you won't have to be kicked around by anybody. And you won't have to depend on anyone for your livelihood, not even on man. My parents taught us to think of education as the first step on the way to freedom. This was particularly true when I was growing up. Mother said to me, you want clothes and other things now, but once you have an education, if you still want these things, you can get them. The most important thing now is to get an education.